The following podcast is a production of Institutional Real Estate Incorporated. Before beginning our program, we would like to invite you to sign up for a free trial subscription to one of our publications at irei.com. Whether you are interested in real estate, infrastructure, or real assets in general, IREI has a publication to suit your needs. Select Publications on the main menu to choose a publication. Interested in more than one? Sign up for them all.
This is Mike Consul, your host. Thank you for joining the program. Our guest is Brad Dillman. He's chief economist for Cortland. Cortland is a multifamily real estate investment, development, and management company. He has been an economist for more than 10 years with an expertise in single family and commercial real estate investment analysis, credit, and quantitative modeling. And Brad has had his mind on the same thing that all of our minds are on right now, which is the COVID-19 virus, also known as the coronavirus. And specifically with Brad Dillman, the impact it is having or may have on the housing market and on home building. I got on the phone with Brad Dillman and asked him some questions surrounding the housing and home building market and the economy more generally. Here's what he had to say.
COVID-19, it's obviously on the loose, worse in some areas than others. If we were to just take a look at the United States, generally, what kind of fallout, economic fallout, are you expecting, are you seeing right now, and what are you expecting as it persists?
Well, the most apparent has just been the general stoppage, right? We did see the supply chain disruptions earlier, you know, from China. Related to this, but I think what's really developed over the last 30 days has been the broader stoppage. We've seen this already in initial claims jumping up first 3.3 million or so, and then a little over 6.5. So if you were to just measure it by that data alone, we've got now nearly 16 million people unemployed if you were to tack on the people who are already unemployed. So that's hopefully temporary, but that's obviously the biggest hit. Most of this has been concentrated in leisure and hospitality. I would also add to it that, that's something that's going to appear like it's going to compound in the short term. I've likened the overall situation to this being like drowning, right? Or being, you know, you're swimming, the longer you're underwater, you know, the worse this is going to get, the sooner we can get back to work as normal, or at least beginning to start work as normal, you know, the better off the economy is going to be. Now, initial estimates right now are that we might get something on the order of a 20 to 30% hit to GDP in the second quarter of this year, which would
That's
be by
huge.
Far and away the biggest hit. Yeah, by far and away the biggest one-time hit to the economy. But you know, a lot of that is just it's the little things that add up. And you know, if everybody just stays home for a week, right? You know, our well-being as human beings isn't fundamentally changed. I mean, GDP is kind of a government calculation here. This is an accounting metric. It's not something that if you were to gauge the well-being of the human population in the United States by GDP, you'd be sorely misguided. So but that's nonetheless a metric for the broader economy. And I mean, it does show that, you know, we would expect this big hit and then hopefully a corresponding rebound over the remainder of the year or certainly into 2021.
My understanding is the housing crisis, your attitude is that the housing crisis that we faced in the global financial meltdown back in 2007, 2008 is not likely to happen now. It's a very different thing going on right now, but at the same time, you've got people who have been sidelined, can't pay their mortgages. Why do you think the housing situation is going to be better this time than it was in 2007, 2008?
At a high level, it's due to supply. So, you know, the great financial crisis experience was centered on the housing market. The housing market was centered on a variety of efforts going all the way back to 1995, the National Home Ownership Strategy, to increase the home ownership rate. You had financial deregulation that encouraged basically, you know, speculation on mortgage-backed securities. We had low rates coming out of the dot-com recession. We had the American Dream Down Payment Assistance Act. We had a number of overlaying monetary and fiscal actions, as well as corporate malfeasance, that contributed ultimately to an oversupply of housing. I estimate that we got as high as about 2.5-3 million excess housing units before that unsustainable situation eventually reversed on itself. that gave us the financial crisis and also the period of underbuilding that we were in for quite a time afterward. I estimate today that we're undersupplied by about 1.3 million housing units nationally. And then when I'm speaking of housing units, I'm meaning apartments and single-family homes, things people live in. Now, most of the undersupply today is because of underbuilding and single-family. Most of the oversupply going into the GFC was oversupply of single-family due to the various financial incentives that prevailed at the time. So that's, at a high level, the reason I don't think housing is set to do a repeat of what it did in 2007, 8, 9, and all the way through 2012. And I could give a whole backstory as to why I think single-family has been undersupplied. I worked for a home builder for a couple of years, and I actually was part of the non-performing loan dispositions by HUD in 2012, 13, and 14. So I saw a lot of the fallout from not only the housing implosion, but the efforts to re-stimulate home prices and their unintended consequences in the market. I got to see that firsthand and what that entails for housing generally, which has been a distortion between prices and incomes and savings and the ability to deliver supply because it simply couldn't pencil.
So isn't part of the problem with housing that there's so many cities now that limit the number of new homes that can be built?
You know, the thing is, a lot of those haven't changed, you know, legally speaking. There were limits on permits and things like this that many jurisdictions put in place during the recession and coming out of it. But when we look at how the cycle fluctuates and how supply fluctuates, the laws haven't really been changing on restricting supply. If anything, they've actually gotten more accommodative, upzoning, you know, efforts towards density. We now have the YIMBY Act, suburban densification, and all this kind of thing. I mean, so I think, and what I saw when I worked for a home builder was really just the pricing. You know, when you lower interest rates, that implies that there's more savings there to support the system. And so when we artificially lower interest rates to support asset prices, it implies that there's more savings there to backstop it. And when those savings aren't there because people don't have jobs or because they don't have incomes or because they have a cost and profile of living that doesn't allow them to accrue savings, it can take years, decades, by mm-hmm. some calculations I've seen, for them to accrue a down payment for home prices where they are. And that can be made worse when you then have those prices sustained by continued interventions to support home prices, such as lowering down payment requirements, as the federal government did 2012 through, you know, 2015. There were several efforts to do that or to lower insurance payments. So I think we got to a point now where we're so undersupplied on the single-family side that it would be difficult to envision a broad-based contraction again. And we also have to remember, prior to the Great Recession, to quote Ben Bernanke, we'd never seen a systematic decline in home prices across the country. So there's reason to believe that part of the reason that happened had to do with the policies in place at the time, and that while we may see, you know, home prices fall in certain areas, or sadly, certain individuals who, no doubt, people who purchased a home, I could just imagine, you know, a millennial couple who's purchased a home that's underwritten to both of their incomes, you know, and they've really reached for it because they're, you know, they're 35 now, and they've spent their entire adult life playing catch-up, being underemployed, unemployed, paying down student debt, migrating to affordability, delaying and downsizing to finally, you know, get to that part of the American dream, only to be in the economic circumstances we are today. It would be quite tragic. But I wouldn't be surprised if some people, unfortunately, are caught off guard by developments in the economy. And there may be pockets of home price depreciation, but I don't know if I wouldn't be convinced that this will be systematic, and a large reason I believe it won't be systematic is due to supply and due to this not only undersupply of broader housing, but single family in particular, or I should say for purchase housing.
So you're talking about these policies, and my understanding is that you say that the financial crisis would only happen as a result of severe oversight on the part of policymakers. Now, policymakers are being really aggressive right now, and the Fed has acted. You see, a $2.2 trillion stimulus plan. It's almost as if they weren't acting, there'd be some real panic right now. Is the current oversight that you're seeing suitable to this situation, or do you think it's reached a level that you would call severe, or is that just something you're concerned about?
I think their actions have been ahead of the curve here. It's important to note, you know, the repo crisis we had in the fall of last year was already the emergence of a financial crisis. You know, the Fed went right back to they didn't call it QE at the time, but it was essentially QE. In my analysis, the repo crisis was due to the origination of new government debt at the front end of the yield curve that siphoned away that shorter-term capital that would have otherwise gone to the repo market. Other people have different explanations, but they had acted very boldly and swiftly. And if we were to make an analogy to the Great Recession, we clearly were running into issues in 2006 and in 2007 with subprime, and Bear Stearns, and then all the way, until late 2008 was when they finally jumped in with QE. Now, of course, they'd cut rates, but it wasn't until late 2008 that we got QE and the zero interest rate policy. And by then, we'd already lost plenty of jobs. Jobs peaked in 2007. In this circumstance, they've been well ahead of the curve with a rapid turnaround of monetary policy in early 2019. So they ceased the balance sheet reduction, started cutting rates. They did do, you could call it stealth QE in the third and fourth quarter of last year, an abrupt stop to it at the end of 2019, only to be resumed in the face of the coronavirus. So I'd say, and that's why I mean at this stage, I don't think it would take a severe oversight on their part for this to devolve into a financial crisis. They've been so ahead of it. They've done so much that, in my analysis, I don't think the risks right now stem from a financial crisis. The risks, really to the economy now stem from the virus and the government's response to it as it relates to closures and this kind of thing. I'm not saying I disagree with the response. I'm just saying that, this 30% hit to GDP, 2 weeks ago, 10 million people had jobs, and now these 10 million people don't. We got to find a way to resume normalcy or otherwise prevent the financial contagion that would be associated from that or with that from spreading more broadly. So I think on the financial side, we're good. From a financial crisis in the Fed sense of the world, I think the part to watch now is how policymakers continue to respond on, call it the stimulus side, the fiscal stimulus side.
So what about the Fed lowering the prime rates? They've lowered interest rates to basically zero. What is your expectation as to the impact that's going to have on home buying and mortgage refinancing?
Well, right now, we saw the 10-year come down very significantly, hitting new record lows earlier this year. Now, obviously, it was related to this risk-off mentality forming due to, I think, first financial markets in late 2019, but then compounded by the virus. I think the most interesting thing is that mortgage spreads have not followed suit yet. I think there was a rush of refinancing and purchasing that kept the spread kind of fat, as well as just the general uncertainty. So mortgage rates and the 10-year have kind of decoupled. They tend to move reasonably well together. I think what may happen if policymakers are successful in stabilizing current issues, we may see that spread start to come in, which would translate to lower mortgage rates. And I run a suite of models, and some of those models started to kick out sub 3% mortgage rates, in 60 days or so. Now that requires a ton of assumptions, and everybody's got their different model. But I wouldn't be surprised that if the 10-year stays low, and especially if work starts to get back to normal, say next month, and I mean start to, it's going to take time to recover from it. But I wouldn't be surprised if we start to see mortgage rates come back down, which just to run by that rule of thumb of mortgage activity and mortgage rates that we might see some activity, continue, or at least an increase in affordability. There's no doubt we're going to see a big hiccup in housing. That measure of a return of affordability or continuation of it may be felt as well.
Let me ask you about supply chains, because it's looking like supply chains, the global supply chains, one of the things that's going to come out of the whole coronavirus experience is that our supply chains globally we're too dependent on too few supply chains and too distant supply chains. There's now talk about supplying things more locally, or at least having part of the supply chain being domestic so that we don't get caught in a pinch. What about it with regard to home building materials? What are you seeing right now with the COVID-19 virus out there? Is it impacting the home building material supply chain?
Yeah, we felt that earlier, really, with when China was experiencing it. Now, of course, we have the work stoppage, that's occurred here. Now, some construction sites have been able to continue operations, and they're operating at about 80% strength is the guidance I'm getting from our construction side, which, you know, that could be, that would extend the project, you know, by at least an extra, you know, 48 to 60 days in a year. So that's what we're seeing at a high level. I do think that we're probably still on a trend of, if you want to call it inshoring, or at least Western Hemisphere shoring, in the case of the United States, that we'll see, you know, the incentives have been put in place under the policies of the Trump administration to start to, you know, find reason to source, you know, from the Western Hemisphere as opposed to abroad, and the complications that may have, not only as it relates to geopolitics, but then, of course, as it relates to things like the virus and other governments' responses to it. Now, one of the things that's weird for our space is that certain materials are almost entirely sourced from certain areas. So it has to do with, you know, aspects of countertops or the sourcing of, you know, certain finishings and fixtures. You know, we've seen a lot of production migrate out of China and into Southeast Asia. And, you know, we've been on a quest at different times to find the appropriate place to source for the, you know, what's going to be the new node that develops to, you know, to deliver these items that's outside of China. And that's, I think that is still open to debate. And it won't always necessarily be, you know, in the Western Hemisphere, but it would seem to be that's falling into play.
You know, you reference Big Three REITs, the Big Three REITs. Who are the Big Three REITs with regard to housing?
I look at UDR and Equity Residential and Camden. Or I don't know if they would be referred to as the Big Three. That's not my note, but those are the three that I tend to watch for a bit. Now, I think the issue with the REITs right now really has been, you know, they are publicly traded entities, and by extension, they are strongly affected by the broader dynamics in equity markets. I track Camden, for example, is a group that, you know, has a similar footprint to us. So that is a group that I pay a little bit more attention to. But I, as an economist, I actually tend to not look at the publicly traded REITs because I'm trying to look at the data behind the scenes, not just the way that equity markets are overreacting to different information at different times. But as it relates to, I guess, the real point here is a trend towards renting, or do people, you know, because of current circumstances, is there a changing attitude towards density? And I know there's speculation on that. You know, in other comments I've made, I think it's abundantly clear a lot of the move towards density we've seen over the last 10 years has been very policy-driven at a local level, transit-oriented development. At an academic level, this has been discussed. I mean, geez, I studied it in college in the early part of the century. Even at the United Nations level, there's been a push, you know, for urbanization and this kind of thing of developing countries and this kind of thing. So, you know, density is with us and it's here to stay. We're going to have different attitudes towards it, you know, for sure. And I do think, you know, suburban style multifamily communities are going to fare a lot better in the sense that they've got a little bit more space, more spacious hallways, you know, they're garden style developments in a lot of cases, as opposed to, you know, these high rises where everything's just a lot closer. Now, how the consumer fully responds to that's, you know, a different question, but it's clear that these sort of suburban, and I guess we should say in a world of density, you know, slightly less density is king, these, you know, suburban jurisdictions, I think, will see outperformance. And indeed, they have seen outperformance over the last 5 years or so. There's just been so much apartment supply concentrated in these urban core submarkets that they've, you know, it's made for a very competitive environment. At the same time that those projects, you know, are they're really competing for a very small segment of the renter distribution, these people with, you know, six-figure incomes and up, at the same time that the population generally has been migrating en masse to affordability and opportunity, and that's both, you know, between metropolitan areas and then within them, which has included this migration outward. That's led to some of this suburban and peripheral apartment outperformance.
So let's pan back, and as you look at the overall economy, seeing how the economy has been waylaid, I mean, structurally, the economy was looking pretty good, even though people were predicting a 2021 recession. A lot of economists were anyway. This was just obviously a major body blow. So what are the prospects going forward in terms of the economy rebounding? What kind of timeline, and this might go outside the scope of really where you focus, but what kind of timeline do you think we're looking at? Is your expectation the economy would rebound pretty quickly if we're able to tame this? Well, let's say it goes away during the summer, like some people are expecting, at least a temporary respite from it. And then also maybe then narrow down to the housing market itself. What do you say about those?
I think we definitely are going to need to see a return to a measure of normalcy relatively quickly. You know, the longer this stoppage continues, the more the labor market's going to unravel. It's already unraveled immensely. And if that gets worse, that's just going to create bigger problems. Perhaps the most of which is the permanent changes to society and the role of government based on the way the government chooses to respond to it. For example, you know, you might see the de facto development of a lot of social policies that aren't really debated, but are simply rather imposed by necessity. So I do think that could be problematic. If I were to look at the general timeline right now, I see two things. I see one is there's some measure of a return to normalcy, let's say in May, in which case we might start to feel a little bit of a rebound in late Q3 or Q4, or there's it getting extended a little bit, in which case I think it gets pushed into whatever administration comes next and we see a rebound in, you know, in March or February or so. Now I'm speaking in terms of general, you know, employment activity, not GDP, because I think GDP has got the potential to be very volatile here. I'm speaking of it in terms of, you know, the employment base. Generally, what I would expect, you know, that we will not retain or re-achieve, I should say, the number of jobs that have already been lost, you know, probably for a year to 2 years. And the more this gets delayed, it may be like 2 years out that it takes to kind of recoup all these jobs. You know, there's never been a V-shaped recovery in my read of things, certainly not when it comes to labor markets. And so I do think under the current circumstances, that's a possibility on the labor side. If things start getting back to normal pretty quickly, a lot of these folks who've just lost their jobs may find themselves right back where they were a couple weeks ago. But if this gets extended and the labor market continues to unravel, I think we're going to see it, you know, slowly move up the labor hierarchy. Right now, it's, you know, very concentrated in hourly workers and in the hospitality sector, but pretty soon you're going to see the suppliers to those businesses and then the, you know, financial organizations, you know, related to them start to feel the pinch, and it's simply going to get worse. And that may be matched by a government response that, you know, I don't want to say simply gets worse, but simply entails a lot of other changes. You know, you kind of get this entropy that begins to form.
Mm. So how much of the labor problem is, are you concerned it will be psychological in terms of people being out of work for any extended period of time? I mean, one of the things they said about the 2007-2008 crisis was it had a corrosive effect on just basically on people's minds, because they really were set back in a big way. And it was difficult for some of them to really get back to work, and maybe not entirely because they couldn't find a job, but also maybe because of some of the emotional trauma that they had to deal with. Now, I know you're not a psychologist, but economics kind of encompasses everything. So everything is relevant. So I don't know whether you have anything to say about that, but I was curious whether that's part of your concern about what could happen if this is extended out.
Yeah, I'm not a psychologist, but I did marry one. my wife was a clinical psychologist at Harvard for a time. I do think that the psychology played a big role, not so much the loss or fear of loss, but I think the sense of being left behind on the reflation of assets. I've gone back and forth with our CEO on this. I don't think millennials are driven by a fear of loss. I think they're driven by a fear of or desperation at this point because of what, in effect, has been the decline in the standard of living in this country over the last 10 years. I do think that you can still see the ramifications of a lot of this. We've seen, you know, the deaths of despair and this kind of thing. And the last I've seen, you know, this country's suicide rates were still climbing. And here we are 10 years into recovery, getting ready to roll into, you know, the next economic disruption. And those figures are still incredibly high. I think you also see this in the ability of, you know, people to form families And I think you see it in mental health generally. I think you see it in loneliness. The UK, for example, appointed a minister of loneliness, I want to say in early 2018, to address some of these problems. And yeah, if the economy really does unravel, I wouldn't be surprised, sadly, to see more deaths of despair. And I think, you know, the psychology of fear of loss can certainly be at play. And I think that'll encourage people to make, you know, relatively conservative financial decisions when they can. But I think the reality is you're looking at a lot of people who, you know, are simply desperate. And if the only way they can get into a house, you know, at 35 to, you know, to 40 to try to have a family before it becomes, say, problematic from a biological perspective, the only thing they can do is, you know, migrate from L.A. to Seattle and then over to Boise to buy a $500,000 house with 5% down underwritten to two incomes. You know, people are going to do what they got to do. And if that ends poorly, it may end poorly, you know, for them psychologically.